Okay. Thank you, Jim. Thanks, Martha. Thanks, Andy. Thanks, oh patient students. If you're really out there, would you wave your hands at me, oh patient students? Yay! Oh, I have many fond memories of being in the room you're sitting in right now. In fact, I helped to design some of the AV in that room. Not the part that's not working now, but the part that does work. So I thought I'd start out just by talking a little bit about what sort of lies behind as a backstory for the stuff that you've been reading and viewing from me, and then maybe bring that a little bit up to the present in terms of what I'm thinking about now along these lines, and then open it up for some questions and answers. I don't know. I can't promise answers, but if we get to some really good questions tonight, I think we'll have accomplished something. So, you know, I've been using computers since 1988, and it had some really weird intuitions about computers. Actually, I guess the first time I ever really used a computer was in 1982 or so, first time I ever logged on to a computer system. And I don't know. I mean, it's something about the way I'm wired cognitively, I guess. It always seemed like there was something really interesting there. I couldn't put my finger on it, but I had a feeling that it would be, at some point in my life, something that I'd be following up on. And as it turned out, that was very much the case. But I say that because I didn't really come up through the computer science developments of the 70s or the 80s. I was not an early adopter of the personal computer, which appears in the very early 80s, and I didn't get mine until 1988. So in a lot of ways, this all kind of crept up on me. It took me by surprise. And in some ways, the fact that it did take me by surprise, along with this kind of hunch I had all along that there was something there, it brought things to a boil with me pretty quickly when the time came and the light bulb switched on. And that was really in the early part of the 21st century. When I'd been using computers in teaching and learning. I'd been on the web. I'd done various kinds of things with applications and so forth. But it was about that time, about 2004, that the real change happened for me, which leads me to the point where I am now. And it's at that point I really begin to understand what the internet means, what interactive computing means. Now, I want to emphasize this point. I had owned a computer for 16 years by that time. I was one of the alpha geeks at Mary Washington. I knew a lot of stuff about how to use a computer. I wasn't a programmer, but I had used listservs to my classes. I had done web things. I had made web pages. I knew HTML. I had done a lot, and I had known about computers and been thinking about computers by that time for, over 20 years. And yet it wasn't until 2004 that I really began to understand what interactive computing meant and what networked computing meant. And the way I found it out was when I really got on the web the first time. Now, that too is kind of a strange thing to say, because I've been on the web, I had many email addresses, I had websites all over the place, blah, 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 blah. I knew, 2004 wasn't that long ago. Google was full speed ahead, everybody in Web 2.0 was here, everything was going. But I didn't really know what that meant. I didn't really understand what it meant to be on the web until I got an account on a hosting service and began to blog. And what happened at that point really was a turning point for me, because for the first time I began to understand, or as you might call it, which is a lovely 1960s word for a kind of complete understanding that's physical as well as mental. It's just a whole body understanding. I began to grok what it meant to have a digital identity. Before that, I had always used what other people had given me. It was either an application in shrink wrap, or as we got into more cloud-based stuff, I would be using the public.html folder that I got as a faculty member at Mary Washington, or I might enroll in an internet forum somewhere. I had various things I was using, but I wasn't really a citizen of the internet because I didn't have a hosting service where I could actually interact with a web server in a way that connected me very directly
to the capacity to build something out in terms of a digital identity on the web. And so that was part of it, getting on the hosting service. The other part was having a blog, because a blog is a very curious little critter. You can understand it in about 5 minutes, and then you can spend 5 years trying to figure it out. It's an essay, it's a book, it's a diary, it's an ongoing narrative about the ongoing narrative of constructing a narrative for yourself. It's nothing but links. It's everything but links. It's all about a kind of essayistic authorial privilege. It's all about an indirect and distributed conversation. It's a very strange genre, but it includes storytelling because of the way it's set up, reverse chronological order, most recent first. And it's very webby in the way that these links operate. You get trackbacks that come up as kind of indirect comments. When you make a link, you're doing something that's a lovely kind of indirect citation. When you make a link to somebody and they see you've linked to them, they're very likely, using what Brian Lamb calls the power of positive narcissism, to say, who's this discerning person who's linked to my blog? And then they come over and look at yours. All of these things started happening for me within about 2 weeks of doing the blog, because I was very aggressive about blogging about things I was interested in, things I enjoyed, people I was reading on the web, and so forth. And because the web is a place where the audience can find you and the audience can find each other, as it turned out, I started getting all these spooky responses. I would write about, reading a column by somebody who wrote for, it was called, it was like it's Power PC. It wasn't that. Oh, it was a CPU magazine, right? And the guy's name was Chris Perillo. And so I wrote a little blog post. Hey, I read Chris Perillo. I was really interested in what he had to say, blah, blah, blah. You know, and a day later, he would leave a comment. Now, how did he know that I had done that? And how did he find my blog? I was one of a bazillion blogs, and I was just, little old me. Why did somebody who wrote for a magazine suddenly see that I was saying something about him and be able to pop over and the comment he left? I still remember it. It's the internet's a spooky place, isn't it? And yeah, Chris Perillo found my blog. What's that about? One of the early blog posts I wrote was about a CD-ROM game that my kids played when they were growing up back in the day when the Oregon Trail was really the hot thing to run on your computer. And it was a thing called Silly Noisy House. And I blogged about it. Somebody saw the blog, sent the blog link to the woman who developed Silly Noisy House, and suddenly I was in a conversation with her. Why were these things surprising to me? Because I did not understand the way the web worked. I didn't really understand the internet. What I understood was how to use things people had given me to put things out on the internet. But that's very different. And what I began to intuit from all of this activity that started to happen was that there were people out there who understood what it was like to have a digital identity, what it was like to be a citizen of the web, and what it was like to use the tools in a kind of symbiotic way, so that if somebody blogged about Chris Perillo, Chris Perillo would find it. If somebody blogged about Silly Noisy House, somebody would see that. They understood how to get out on the web and make the web work for them as a citizen in that environment. Now, this was brand new to me. And as I said, it did have a kind of a spooky element to it. It was also very encouraging because, as you know, if you put a message in a bottle and it floats to Fiji and somebody in Fiji finds it and then they get back in touch with you, it's like, hey, cool, my little bottle, it went all the way to Fiji. This is kind of interesting. And that would happen, and this is also the nature of the web. It would accelerate. The fact that it happened made me do it more. The more I did, the more it happened, and so forth. And at one point, I was reading one of my favorite authors on the web, a guy named John Udell. He was introduced, I found out about his work actually from a fellow at Mary Washington, Jerry Slezak. He said, you should take a look at this heavy metal umlaut band video. And I was like, whoa, what's that? So I went and looked at it, blew me away. So I started reading John Udell all the time and would look to him for my blog. I still didn't understand that if I did that, he would see I had done that. So one day I'm reading him, and he's writing about the same thing that I'm writing about. And I thought, well, that's very odd. Why would he be doing that? Great minds think alike. I had no clue. The next day I read him, and I see that he links to me. And I thought, well, how on earth did he find me? And then it all gradually began to dawn on me that if you're a real digital citizen, if you are in the web and not just with a little placeholder on the web, the whole thing acts as this really big brain that's self-aware if you understand how to wire it together. And this was a complete revelation to me. As it would happen, at the very same time I was experiencing the first thrill of being a blogger and being in this spooky place where things happened automagically, I began reading some of the founding documents of the history of computing. I hadn't done that before because I thought, well, you have to be a computer scientist to do that. What I quickly discovered was that the people who wrote about computers in the early days of computers were writing not so much about programming as they were writing about brains. What did it mean to take a mind made up of a network of neurons and try to pattern a sophisticated and complex communication system after that kind of model? Now, you can't do that with a telephone, you can't do it with radio, you can't do it with television. But with this thing called interactive computing, and as people began to scale that upwards, this idea that we would interact online, which was a new word, right? People who did that found it very hypnotic and very, they talked about holding power, that when you were in that kind of contact, you really did feel like you were inhabiting other people's minds and vice versa, because something about the networked possibilities so closely resembled what we kind of feel is happening in our own heads, that there was a kind of a feedback effect. And you began to think about thinking while you were thinking and communicating with other people. And it all got very, as we say, recursive. The process became something that folded back in on itself. So I started reading some of this literature, and it was breathtaking. Vannevar Bush in 1945, long before there were transistors or digital computers, imagining that if we paid attention to the way our minds worked, we might be able to devise a more sophisticated system for linking things by association, not by a kind of top-down indexing, the way you would in a conventional library setting back in the day, where you would look up topics, and you'd have subtopics, and then sub-subtopics. But you would actually link from one thing to another. He didn't really use the word link, but clearly he was thinking about this. This is 1945, and I'm looking at this, and I'm like, why did nobody ever tell me to read this stuff? This is fantastic. Then I found out that a fellow named Douglas Engelbart had read Vannevar Bush while Engelbart was stationed in the South Pacific, maybe on Fiji as far as I know, and he read this article and he thought, oh, that's interesting. And Engelbart had been a radar station operator, and he started getting interested in visual kinds of interaction that would happen in a networked computing scenario. And he had this vision that somehow we would be able to link together in this very complex and sophisticated way and actually be able to do what he called augmenting our intellect. We would kind of establish a feedback loop between the communication we were doing with each other and the communication that was going on internally in our own thoughts, and we'd be able to express all of that in a very complex way visually with an interactive computer. Now, this is in the 1950s. There are about three computers in the United States at this point. And just to show you how ironic history can be, Engelbart applied for a job at Hewlett-Packard and got the job and was all fired up about that, thought it was great, but as he was driving home, he realized he had not asked them about computers, and he meant to do that. So he called the person up he'd interviewed with, might have been either Hewlett or Packard, as far as I know, and he said, look, this is great. I'm really happy about this job. I'm really looking forward to it, but I need to tell you that one of the things I'm really, really interested in is computers, and I wonder, is that something, I'm assuming you all are going to get into that, something I'd be able to work on? And the person said to him, no, we have no plans to be involved with computers. We're not going to be working on that. They were all about radio instrumentation and things like that. And computers were what you used either to calculate missile trajectories or to try to come up with statistical models that you would use, say, in an insurance company. It was very clerical kinds of things. So Engelbart had this vision, and as I quickly found out, the vision was one that eventually became what we call interactive computing, which was debuted to the world in 1968 on December 9th over in San Francisco, what's called the mother of all demos. So here I am, right? It's 2005 at this point, I guess. I'm just beginning to understand what it means to be on the web in a way that's not just kind of plug and play doing what people tell me I can do, but have access to a web server, have access to a specific and extensible kind of digital identity. And I'm reading all of this stuff about the beginning of computing when what they're thinking about is mental activity. They're thinking about learning, what this might be for education. And I felt like I had stumbled onto a portal into the future that had been there, you know, for a long time since before I was even born. And I thought, this is so odd. Why is it this way? Nobody has told me about this. What's the deal? We should be doing something very different from what we're doing in school, given this kind of rich and very vital sense of possibility. Well, never underestimate the power of school to overlook vital and interesting possibilities as they're trying to get you to your degree. And we're all kind of complicit in that, right? We would like it all to be very comfy and very 1, 2, 3, and give me the degree, and now it's over with, and now, you know, I start the rest of my life, which will also be very comfy and 1, 2, 3. And it's a very dismal prospect, but, you know, we all kind of buy into that. It's hard to get your head around this stuff, because really one of the things you're trying to get your head around is the very nature of mental activity in communication with all these other minds out there. So, yeah, I get it. That's difficult. It's hard to talk about or think about. At the same time, we've never had a tool as powerful as networked interactive computing, especially on this platform, the World Wide Web, to help us think better, richer, more interesting, and more effective thoughts about how we can be working and thinking together. And it was my conviction that the place that should be thinking most about all of this should be higher education. And it seemed to me that there was a huge gap there. It still seems to me that way. And there are reasons for that that we can talk about as we go forward tonight, but it remains a great sorrow to me that of all the places most effectively positioned to think about these amazing possibilities, colleges and universities seem the most addicted to business as usual, maybe because everyone's comfy, or maybe because it's just, you know, too much for people to get their heads around at this point. I don't know. But it's the kind of thing that you're doing in digital storytelling, and the kind of thing I do with my students, and the kind of thing we do when we start to think about how to articulate this revolution we're in. That, I think, is the best hope for trying to push this along. I don't think we're going to be able to train enough faculty fast enough. I don't think we're going to be able to get enough savvy stuff going on with administration fast enough. But I think that in these kinds of learning communities where people are working together to make this idea as powerful as it can be, I think we have a chance there. So just a couple of other things I want to say, and then we'll open it up for some questions, because I get wound up in this. I can go a long time. One of the things that still attracts me to the idea, very powerfully to the idea of a personal cyber infrastructure that I don't really talk about in the Bag of Gold presentation, is the idea that the teacher and the students are using the same materials. And I've been thinking about that a lot, especially since I've been at Baylor. Baylor's a very heavy Blackboard shop, you know, and most schools that do have Blackboard tend to push it pretty hard because it's expensive and you don't want to spend $100,000 a year on something and then just kind of leave it over there for people to discover on their own. So the expense of Blackboard means that there's going to be typically a pretty heavy institutional commitment. But Blackboard is completely administratively controlled. Students can put stuff in, but it tends to be very transactional. Students have no access after the course is over. And more to the point, students cannot build a Blackboard-esque thing within Blackboard. Blackboard exists entirely at the teacher end of things. And to scale it up, it really you're at the mercy of your database operator. And Blackboard itself has no mercy, so we won't go there. But if I'm putting together, using a WordPress platform, something I call a mother blog, which you're seeing now in the very class that you're doing, a blog that aggregates content across everyone's individual blogs, pulling in the contributions into this shared space that serves as a dynamic visualization for the intellectual activity of the class. The thing about that mother blog is it's made out of exactly the same stuff as every student's blog. So every student could make a mother blog. Now, you might not need or want to do that. It wouldn't make too much sense. It might be kind of fun in a freaky way to have everyone's blog become a mother blog, and then you get this lovely kind of infinity picture of all the mother blogs re-aggregating themselves. Actually, as I say that, that would be pretty trippy. That would be kind of interesting. But, Dad, don't do that. But the point is this. By looking at what I do in putting together a mother blog, you see an example that is available to you anytime you want within the very materials you're working with. Now, that's huge. It's right up there with what some teachers do when they show the drafts of an article that they're working on to their students to say, look, there's a process here. There are materials. There are best practices. There are methodologies. There are concepts and frameworks here that I use, and you will use a version of them too. This does not exist within the learning management systems that schools use, and it's native to the idea of this mother blog, this aggregation. And why is that? Because WordPress is of the web. It's not just on the web. WordPress is built along the same lines as the World Wide Web, which is built along the same lines as the Internet, which is built along the same lines of our minds, language itself, which leads me to the next point. Anytime you're working within this system, you get a twofer, right? One thing is you've got a great platform for publishing your work, for embedding all sorts of different media, for linking out to people, for establishing a network of connections there. At the same time you're doing that, you always have available to you one of the most powerful ideas we have. It's really the same idea as civilization itself, which is the network of networks. And I think that that's the thing people come to college to discover. They typically have some vague idea. There's a world out there, and I'll apply for a job, and maybe I'll get married, and then maybe I'll get a degree, and, you know, those sorts of things. But the real powerful lesson of higher education is that civilization is a network of networks, and you are now in that network. Not just as something receiving messages, but you are a productive node in that network yourself. You are now part of this conversation. Now, with something like Blackboard, there is no conversation, first of all, or if there is one, it's very impoverished. And I say this from experience because I used it for years. Sorry, I've atoned for my sins. I'm clean now, but I was once a very dirty Blackboard user. And you know, it was a funny thing. As soon as I switched over to an internet-native discussion board, the participation doubled, and people began to customize and do all these creative things, and none of that was possible in Blackboard. Still isn't possible in Blackboard. But that idea that when you're in the framework of a truly web-oriented personal cyber infrastructure, which WordPress can be a platform for in a very basic way, you're experiencing the network of networks. You're in the conversation about the conversation. And when you have that idea in your head, there really is no limit to what you're going to be able to imagine. And pushing out those limitations on what you can imagine is one of the things that I hold as a sacred trust as a teacher. It's the thing that, in a democratic society, we must have, and it's the thing that has made civilization what it is. I think it's not optional. All these other things, grades, semesters, credit hours, courses, PhDs, MAs, BAs, all those things, the extent to which they lead us to powerful ideas about the network of networks is the extent to which they're useful. The extent to which they hide that idea is the extent to which we must work against them. And that really, I think, was the thing that I was trying to get across in my anger and despair in the Bag of Gold presentation. That what we had with networked interactive computing was the most powerful example of that kind of civilization, that network of networks that we'd ever seen, with these wonderful emergent effects and things just surprising us on a daily basis. And yet people had what seemed to me to be, on the one hand, lame, and on the other hand, weird responses to it, as if it was something that was either too trivial or too complicated or too irrelevant even to entertain. And, you know, I wish I could say that in the 2 years since I presented that talk in Vancouver, I've seen a massive movement in the direction of a little more enlightenment along those lines, but I haven't. What I have seen is a lot of increasingly frantic activity in education, as people are kind of running around saying, well, what do we do? What do we do? We have 10 billion application downloads and 500 bazillion tunes on iTunes, and there's Facebook, and Mark Zuckerberg is Person of the Year, and these kids are texting all the time, and my daughter sends out 7,000 text messages a month, and what do we do? What do we do? And there's the for-profit sector, and everybody's just kind of running around very frantic. And to me, the way to get your head around this is to awaken the digital imagination by getting a clue about what the internet really represents. And that seems to be the thing that's the hardest of all to do. And at a certain level, I still find that difficult to understand. But anyway, I never take up a collection after my sermon, so you're fine. I'm not going to pass the hat, but that's sort of where I am with this. And, you know, Jim mentioned that some folks out there in blogger land were taking my ideas literally in the sense of everybody should have the cPanel experience. I don't believe that. I think that cPanel is interesting because it's an easy-to-use graphical front end for a web server. I think that something like that, that gives people who are not programmers or real hardcore server nerds the ability to do meaningful work in a server environment, is important. But the real important thing is the bigger idea, which is, what does it mean to have a digital identity and be an effective citizen of the web? What does the internet represent as a distributed conversation, as a platform for thinking about the way we think, both individually with the network inside our heads and collectively with the network we're in all together? And when we think about that, what does that help us think about in relation to what I believe is the most delicate, complex, exhilarating, and fraught activity we engage in as human beings, which is this thing we call education. We have this little word for it. I can't think of anything more complex and interesting than dealing with human cognition. That's where it all lives. And how can this internet experience help us understand that more fully? I have ideas about that as well, but I'll stop there and see if folks have questions, pushback, alternative suggestions, or enlightenment to share. Please, I'm still trying to work this out.
Well, I have a question for you, Gardner. This is Jim.
Yep.
Do you hear me?
Hey, Jim. Yep.
Again and again, that comes up in your talk is this idea of citizenship, democracy, right? And then you talked at a moment that there's this crisis point, there's this frantic running around. Do you think we're at a crisis point in that kind of interactive network you're saying that reflects the broad brain also reflects in some ways our society right now and the crisis of democracy we might be going through broadly or more broadly? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, let me try to get an answer, and then you can tell from the answer whether I've understood what you're saying.
Okay.
I think because we have not thought carefully enough about what this means, not just for expression, but for cognition itself, that we're seeing a lot of turbulence on the surface and not a lot of really good activity in the depths of what this internet represents. And because there's so much froth and foam and kind of, you know, pitching back and forth on the rough stuff up on the surface, I think people are looking at that and saying, oh my goodness, you know, that this is all collapsing, it's all wrong, we need to either go back to the hand loom, or we need to, you know, block the wireless signal, or tear down the blogosphere, or, you know, stop BitTorrent and all the rest of that. But I think the thing that hasn't happened, and I think this doesn't happen with democracy either, what's the idea here? You know, what does this represent in terms of the way we think about human potential and human striving? I don't know that everyone needs to be a PhD in political science, but I think we all need to be political scientists and attentive to those issues, just as we need to have our personal cyber infrastructures. I think that the internet operates at an interesting meta level with regard to all of this, but so does democracy in a way. I mean, all of these things are holding forth basic assumptions about what it means to be human and what conduces most readily to human good. And it's easy with all of the noise and all of the polemic and all of the ideologies and all of the back and forth to lose sight of that. It's easy to say, you know, my kid's texting 7,000 times a month. What's that about? Sherry Turkle now wants to say, as she moves away from what I think was her much more interesting earlier work, it's easy to get really frantic about these symptoms, but what's going on underneath, what's there in terms of ideas and the assumptions that I think we might even be able to agree about in terms of freedom is good, self-determination is good, giving people more choices instead of fewer is good. Those things are getting lost in the shuffle. Part of that, I should say, gets talked about really brilliantly, I believe, in Kevin Kelly's new book, What Technology Wants. It's an interesting book. It's repetitive at times, but he's got a big, big view of what he calls the technium, which is the entire ecosystem of technologies that I find really bracing. I don't think he takes computers as seriously as he should, because I think they're in a unique category, along with language and cognition itself. But still, I recommend the book. I don't know if that gets at your question or not, does it?
No, it does, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, another question. Did you want to shout?
Actually,
we're
going to
come up with a shout it.
He should still be, we're going to record it here, too.
Just talk into this?
Yep, just talk just like you are.
Okay, it's kind of a stupid question, but I've always wanted... What, like, we talk about the internet. I was just talking to my friend, actually, about it. I understand that it's, like, connections, but what is, like, physically the internet? Like, what was the setup of the internet? Like, what could crash the internet? You always hear that it can't crash. Like, what physically is the internet?
Yeah, no, that's really a great question, because there is a philosophy of life embedded within the design of the internet. And a book I'll recommend to you, which I think is a fantastic book, Alan Kay, who's really the father of mobile computing, I would say, his idea of the Dynabook leads directly to what we have as laptops today. And he also has said my favorite thing about computers, which is that a computer is an instrument whose music is ideas. I say that over and over before I go to sleep at night. It calms me. It's true, you know. A computer is an instrument whose music is ideas. Anyway, this book is called Dealers of Lightning. It's The Dream Machine. Dealers of Lightning is another one. It's J.C.R. Licklider and the invention of personal computing. And it's a very readable and exciting historical account of the way the internet came to be. What was unique about, there are several things unique about the internet, and I'll just try to go through this fairly quickly. The internet is a network of networks. That's what that means. It is an internet. There were already networks that were local networks within a university or within a business, or, you know, they found they could wire the computers together and have them talk to each other. But very early, J.C.R. Licklider and Bob Taylor and Ivan Sutherland, other people who were working actually for the Department of Defense, as it turns out, they were in the Pentagon, which is kind of interesting, getting kind of leftover money from the Apollo project. It's funny how this all works out. They had this idea that there might be a way to connect these networks so there would not be a central command center, so that every single node on the network would be able to transmit and receive equally, and no one would have to have permission to send that message out. So they were really thinking of a network as a set of autonomous yet connected individual networks or nodes. Now, that's kind of a funny thing. A lot of people didn't want them to do that because they thought this is going to be inefficient, this is going to be chaos. You know, what happens if one machine goes rogue, as Sarah Palin might say, and brings the whole network down? You know, how do we wire this together? But they thought about it, and they came up with some pretty ingenious ideas. One of them was that sitting in between each computer connected to the internet and the backbone of the internet itself, the place where all the interconnections are happening, there would be a little box that would essentially translate whatever was going on in the local network into the internet protocol that would go out over the wires and be able to speak the same language computer-wise among all of the other branches of the network. They figured that out. So essentially there's a little computer that sits between whatever computer you have on your network and the internet itself that actually makes that connection. And later on, that computer actually became part of what was actually on your own computer, a little thing called a TCP/IP stack. So that was there. They had other ideas. They thought, so what if instead of trying to establish what was called a circuit switched connection, which is like a telephone, when I call you, I establish a connection with you, and that connection is live for the whole time we're in communication. They thought it would be more robust and more efficient to do what was called packet switching, which meant that if I send you an email, the bits could get scrambled and sent out in the most effective way over whatever internet line happened to be up at the time. And then on the receiving end, there would be software that would actually pull all the bits together again, because every message would have in it a kind of little meta recipe for how to put the message back together. That's a very crude way of explaining it, and computer scientists would probably be snickering by now, but it's more or less what happens. The way all of that comes together means that essentially no one computer can take the internet down. No one computer controls the internet. Probably the closest that you would get to that would be one of the domain name servers, which allows us to have, you know, www.umw.edu instead of a string of digits. It's a place that translates the actual URL on the web, or the internet address, the IP address on the web, into something that's a word. But even there are multiple redundant DNSs, domain name servers around, and that was the idea that seemed very elegant to these designers, that if you distributed the various points on the network and you didn't build in a single point of failure, it would make the network more robust. It would allow for people to interact very freely in ways that would not have to answer to a central authority. And that seemed to them to be a lot like democracy, which I think is true. And it would allow for maximum experimentation around the edges without bringing the whole system down. So you would get what we call emergent effects. You can wire 100,000 computers together, but then people will be tinkering and stuff will start to happen. Email happened that way. The web happened that way. All of the things we take for granted on the web today, they all happened not because anybody thought of them initially necessarily,
But because once those connections were made, people said, well, what if you did this or what if you did that? Just as when you learn to read and write, you can make up your own sentences. And that turned out to be very, very powerful. It almost wasn't that way. There were people who really wanted it to be very centralized, not because they were evil people necessarily, but because they thought that these other designs were just too wild and too unknown and too unpredictable, and wouldn't it be better to have IBM kind of take care of all of that for us? But my idea in the personal cyber infrastructure piece is that aren't we lucky we didn't get IBM and the master computer we would all dial into? We got the internet instead. And so we need to be able to understand that with our own network of networks, our own personal cyber infrastructure, so that we can work most effectively within this amazing freedom that we have. So I don't know. I mean, I recommend the Dream Machine to you. I think that'll answer these questions in a way that you'd find really satisfying. But it's a fascinating question, and I think it's an important one to ask.
Gardner, I reread the personal cyber infrastructure this week and watched the video. And as you know, in the conversations that have been evolving online around this, one of the things that comes up and as an argument is, well, it's all well and good to say that people need to dive deeper into this and understand this more deeply than maybe they're doing now. But you know, why is that the case? Well, what other technologies do we ask people to do that with? You know, did we ask people to understand how phones work before we ask them to use them? Or to sit on a chair, do you need to know how to build one? And I see some problems with that argument, but I'd love to hear you speak about it. And what it reminds me of, actually, is a podcast I heard you do with John Udell a few years ago. And I wish I could remember what exactly you two were discussing at this point in the recording, but I remember you comparing all of this to language, the idea that this is about equivalent to what it means to learn how to speak. And so to me, these seem like very different domains, building a chair versus how to live within the digital world. But could you talk a little bit more about how you respond to that argument?
Yeah, I'll start with something that comes out of the Kevin Kelly book. He articulated this very beautifully. Kevin Kelly titled his book, What Technology Wants, to kind of, you know, I wouldn't say pick a fight, but to raise a really interesting question, which is, why is it we can see very clearly the potential and the meta level of stuff that's born, but not stuff that's made? So he wanted to try to argue that we can see things that are made, but we don't understand what that represents in terms of potential or in terms of what the underlying structures could be. And his first example was language, which I loved because I thought, that's right, I think so too. But here's the deal. You know, language is a technology, and if you doubt that, take a linguistics course. I mean, we can talk about to what extent there's a language center that's in the brain already, but even in something like a freshman comp course, you can tell that the tool of language is unlike a chair or a hammer. It has this meta level, so that when you're using language well, you're always thinking at two levels, about the thing that you're trying to express and about the attempt to be expressive. This is one of the reasons it's so difficult to learn to write well. You have to do both at once. And it seems to me that unless we're content for people simply to memorize phrase books and speak in highly patterned, memorized sentences, we need to be able to teach language, reading and writing in a way that sets people free to use the technology of language in a way that always has those two levels. This is what I'm trying to say, and these are the things I think about when I try to say something. This, to me, is why a computer is very different from a toaster or a car or a chair or whatever. The computer also has this meta level built in. Alan Kay talks about the computer's facility as a meta medium, so that when you look at it, you're looking at the possibility of emulating other media. Clay Shirky talks about the way in which
digital life as mediated to us through computers brings all other media into it. So right now, I have television, I have radio, I have text, I have all of these media coming to me through the experience of networked interactive computing. That meta level, in which we're looking not just at an object that's been made, but a set of ideas about the possibilities of simulating all the media that we find in our lives and use to take in reality, all that makes the computer very different from other things. So the first thing I have to say is, the computer is not like a hammer. It's not like a chair. It's not like a car. It has superficial resemblances in that it's a manufactured object. But no one would ever look at a book and say, well, that's just wood pulp and boards. Why do you have to know anything about the words in there? It's just a manufactured object. But we all understand that the book is the carrier for this other thing that's happening. The computer, to quote Alan Turing, one of the fathers of computing, is a universal machine. Its property is to be able to simulate all other media. And because of that, it's a lot more like the language in the book than it's like the physical carrier of the book itself. And all of the visionaries who gave us the computer age that we have today understood that. And almost no one in education understands that. But the people in education who do understand it have very powerful things to say, not just about computers, but about learning itself. I'm reading Seymour Papert's The Children's Machine right now, and it's, you know, it's just mind-blowing. This stuff is out there. It's like this little underground of people who keep thinking we must be able to do this better, and the computer is the best way we've ever had to think about thinking. And, you know, who knows? Maybe it'll catch on. I would like to see that.
Do you think that maybe part of the reason people in academia and also people just in general are kind of adverse to leaping on to the ideas that you've been discussing is because, first of all, the internet and personal computers are relatively new in terms of their accessibility for people in a wider range, and also because it's still kind of shrouded in a very nerdy, geeky image that the only people who like computers or like the internet live in their mom's basements. I'm just to go with the stereotype, do you think that maybe that's part of the reason why people would rather stick with what they know, even if it's really clunky, than start something new?
Yes. I think those cultural reasons are all absolutely there. What continues to flummox me is why so many smart people who've done so much advanced work in school and pride themselves on being able to think outside of established paradigms, pride themselves on their ability to be radical and revolutionary and do important new work in their field, get so helpless and feeble-minded in the face of a computer. I understand the cultural reasons. I think you're absolutely right. I am a little bit comforted by the fact that in the book's early days, people hadn't figured that out either. It was like, well, what's a book for? And which way should the pages go? And what's the, oh, we could do a table of contents. Oh, that, a table of contents? What a great idea. You look at these early books, and some of them are kind of higgledy-piggledy. And it took a while to sort that out. If this is, as I believe, as big a revolution, not as the printing press, but as language itself, it will take a while to sort it out. That said, it seems to me that higher education ought to be in the business, A, of sorting this out, and B, helping students understand what sorting it out might look like under these circumstances. We understand history. The people in my field, literary studies, we know. If you wanted to see the first run of Hamlet, you had to go to the wrong side of the river, wade through the sewage, and elbow your way through the whores and the pickpockets to see Hamlet in its first run. And Shakespeare was widely derided because, you see, he hadn't gone to Cambridge or Oxford, didn't have a degree. He was just this upstart crow, as they called him.
So we can look at that example and we can say, oh, the professors in 1600 got it wrong. The great revolution in human expressive capability was happening in a place that we would have written off as a place where the riffraff go. It was fraught with all of these cultural difficulties. Well, having seen that, why can't we then map that on to at least our curiosity about what might be happening now? But it doesn't happen. It's as if you're on a really big boat in the North Sea, and you've seen Titanic, and you understand about icebergs, but you do it again anyway. It's like, what? We know how this story goes. Why can't we get our heads around that, especially since all of us pointy-headed intellectuals are supposedly in the business of being able to see around corners a little bit better because we live off the sweat of other people to be able to think about these things. In my darkest moments, I'll tell you what I think the big cultural impediment is. Everybody is in a very comfortable arrangement for making money and living their lives, and nobody wants to mess with that. And that's what I think is the most powerful cultural reason of all. Because once you start thinking really spooky thoughts about the internet, it's hard to see where that's going to stop. And I think it's pretty easy to see that the educational business as usual that we have right now is absolutely unsustainable and should be reformed forthwith. People don't want to face that, you know? They'd rather be in a mediocre and meaningless relationship than have to think it all up again. And I understand that on a certain level, but where's the spirit of adventure? I mean, let's rock. It's the Beatles. It's Shakespeare. It's a great time to be alive. Come on. You want to wait until Frankie Avalon comes around again? I don't.
We've got one more question. I know there are some Jim's section is actually ending right now, so there may be some people who have to leave for other things. But we've got one more question from a student in my section. So if you can bear with us, Turner.
Sure. Of course.
Okay. So you talked about like the brain and how that you can easily relate it to with the brain and its functions versus like the computer with its computing power versus its storage, its amount of information it can hold. When is a computer going to pass the Turing test, do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. There's an interesting thing that's out there on the web actually made by the woman who made Silly Noisy House, whose name, unfortunately, I can't remember right now. That's why we have computers. I could look it up. And it's called the reverse Turing test. What you have to do is convince the computer that you're a human instead of having the computer convince you it's a human. It turns out that that's not easy to do either. So, you know, at a certain level, I think a Turing test is fun to talk about, but may not be like the gold standard for figuring out what AI is going to be. And I think the other thing is, and this gets back to the artificial intelligence debate, there's a really good book about this called What the Dormouse Said. It's about the 60s counterculture and the personal computing revolution. John Markoff talks about how early computing people were really divided into two camps. There were the artificial intelligence people who wanted to build a machine that would pass the Turing test, let's say. And then there were the augmentation people, led by Doug Engelbart, who thought of a computer not as being a replica of human intelligence, but an augmentation of human intelligence, a kind of symbiotic brain that was both alien and fully connected to our own. And I think that computers have already passed that test, frankly. I think that as we interact with computers, and this is certainly going to be even more the case as we get into gesture-based computing and immersive kinds of 3D experiences with computers that won't even have us in front of a screen. We'll just be walking along with augmented reality all around us. What we're looking at is like a brain, but it's not like our brains. It's like a different kind of brain, which has its own forms of responsiveness. And I don't know, self-awareness, maybe. It's hard to say. No one really knows what consciousness is or how it emerges. But I think we're going to look at something that won't have to convince us it's human, because we will be glad that it is not. And at the same time, it's fully connected and intertwined, as Ted Nelson would say, with our own processes. I think at that point, we're going to have some pretty cool stuff to explore. And we're already seeing some of how that goes now, I believe.
So that, I don't know. It may be that one day a computer will pass the Turing test, but it may be that we'll come up with a different way of thinking about what a computer's thinking might be.
Thank you, Gardner.
Thank you very much.
Gardner, before you go...
Thank you.
Before you go, I need to do. We're going to try to sync this audio up with the video, if possible. So I need to do. I need to do the old filmmaker's trick. What I need you to do, right? We do a clapper. We might need to do an even louder sound.
Okay.
And have you be even more animated. So I want you to say into your microphone the words "boom" three times and use your hands as an explosion. Okay. So go ahead.
What's my motivation here?
I'm the director. I'm your motivation.
Sounds just like Stanley Kubrick.
Okay, exactly. Right.
Boom!
One more. You're doing great.
Boom!
Excellent. Thanks very much, Gardner.
My pleasure.
Great to see you.
Thanks, folks.